I'm Mark Steiner. We're here in Betty Robinson's home in Baltimore. There's a book called Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC that at least I and many others, but at least I have been waiting for a long time and went through many machinations to make sure we could do some of this live in person as opposed to on the telephone and from a distance, because this is a very powerful piece of our history. It's a very powerful piece of American history, of the history of the movement, and it's important because it's being seen through the eyes of women. And it's never usually seen that way. It's always seen through the eyes of men and men in the movement. And women played a very powerful, not just role, but leadership in the movement, and is always given short shrift on some counts. And this is a book that just takes the entire history of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which we will talk about here in a moment. We're in Betty Robinson's house. Betty Robinson was in SNCC, a staffer from 1964 to 1966. She's now a community activist here in Baltimore, causes still a lot of ruckus here in our town, so which is a good thing. Sitting next to her is Judy Richardson, who is a documentary filmmaker now, done some great things in documentary
Eyes
world.
Eisner Prize.
An incredible documentary series. And she was a SNCC staffer from 63 to 1966. And Dottie Zellner is next to me, and Dottie was SNCC staffer from 62 to 67, and also continuing as an activist in this country. So thank you for letting us come in your home to do this.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Thank you for, you know, having us on your show so that we can tell our story and engage other people in the excitement of the book.
So talk about the origin of this book. I'm curious about how the three of you, all of you, got together to say this book has to happen, has to be produced. I remember you talking to me, Betty, about when you were putting it together. You kept saying there's a book coming out. We're doing it on the women of SNCC, and it's going to be coming out. And so it was all very exciting. So how did this start?
Well, we were reminiscing last night at the Baltimore Book Party, and Jean Wheeler Smith Young, there are actually six editors, but Jean Wheeler Smith Young, who lives in Fort Washington, Maryland, she was the one who called us all together and suggested the project.
Mm-hmm. And so then it grew. I mean, it was amazing because originally, I think, you know, there were six of us who she called, and who else can we work with, and who else can we work with, and we got six of us. And we weren't all in this area. As a matter of fact, Dottie's coming from New York. I'm coming from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And then at some point, Faith Holzhardt started coming from West Virginia because she moved. So it was really, though, then it became, it's got to be more than the six of us. It's got to be, you know, all of the women who really represented SNCC. And so you've got 52 women in this book, which is why it took 15 years.
This actually started 15 years ago.
15 years. We set out the call to about 200 women.
200 women. We found addresses for all of the women who had been involved in SNCC in one way or another, in the local projects in the South, in some of the northern offices, students who left school to join SNCC. So we found approximately 200 addresses, and we sent a letter out in, it would have been 1995, saying we're putting this book together, we want the voices of women in this book, and write us your story. One incident, tell us about your life, tell us about what you did. And we gave them several different choices.
And the other thing we said, though, I think, was that the requirement was that you would have been in a SNCC or SNCC-related project for a significant amount of time based in the South, because we didn't just want the women who had come in for 1964 Freedom Summer and then left.
Uh-huh.
We wanted
Which
folks
was the
who,
many, many people many, came to Mississippi for that summer.
That's exactly it. And we had 700 volunteers. So the question was, how do you have people who, women, who really can represent that SNCC experience in a very truthful way, their own truth, whatever that truth is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I would just add that from the outset, this was an interracial project with three black women, three white women. And we wanted the book to reflect the movement itself. So we knew this had to be a majority black women's mm-hmm. book. Because, you know, there were thousands of people who went south for at some point or another. The other thing is some women were kind of shy about doing this and didn't exactly know how to do it. And so we suggested, tell us the stories that you have told to your children, your grandchildren, your neighbors about what it was like. And we never told them what to write about. So every piece is very individual. And it's what the woman herself decided she wanted to tell the world.
And that's an interesting way to approach it, too, it seems to me. And that's why you could feel that through all the writings in this book. Because that is what happened to all of you individually. It's what pushed each one of you to join a movement at in a very precarious time, in a very dangerous time.
But a time that really called us to do this. I mean, that's sometimes young people will say, "Oh my gosh, you were so brave." And I'm like, "Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to deny that, but at the same time the times called on us to act and to take those risks and be engaged in a way that maybe people before us hadn't been, and very often some people, you know, maybe the time maybe what I want to say is the times now, I think, are calling young people especially to make this kind of commitment and work in the trenches in the communities that are suffering from the unemployment crisis, from the housing crisis, from the lack of equitable distribution of wealth, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, let's talk a bit about your parts in this. I think it'd be good for our listeners to get a sense, our viewers to get a sense mm-hmm. of what it is that drove each one of you mm-hmm. to become a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And maybe also describe it, because many people hear the word SNCC and they don't know what SNCC is or what that meant. Mm-hmm. Because it's that, you know, it's that word out there that, mm-hmm. you know, from another generation, another time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think SNCC, first of all, is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It comes as a result of the student sit-ins that break out in February 1st, 1960, starting with North Carolina and A&T, black college, all of them coming from historically black colleges. And then it mushrooms. And so you have these humongous amount of demonstrations coming out of these black campuses in the South, but also being with sympathy demonstrations at Woolworths. And it's around, at that point, just integrating lunch counters and public facilities in these local facilities. And then Miss Baker, who is this amazing woman who is behind us here.
Ella Baker.
Yes. And she is the one who calls, gets all of these student leaders coming out of like Diane Nash and Marion Barry and a number of folks, John Lewis are coming out in Nashville. You've got, out of Atlanta, Julian Bond, Ruby Doris Robinson. You have a number of folks being called in to her alma mater, which was Shaw University, another black college. In North Carolina, and she brings these student leaders together. Her assumption is that they will be able to coordinate some of the activities. But then it becomes a permanent organization after that. The next month? I think it's the next, it's April 15th. Anyway, within a month it becomes a permanent organization. And so, but what's interesting is that a lot of people think that SNCC was only about integrating lunch counters. And in fact, that first speech, one of the first speeches that people know about, which is at the March on Washington, that John Lewis gives on behalf of SNCC, he talks about economic disparities. And he says, what is there in this bill, this 1964 Civil Rights Bill, that will provide money for a woman making $2 a day in the home of somebody making $70,000 a year? And so SNCC is saying that in 1963. We also had a Free Southern Theater, talking about, right. And Denise Nicholas is in our book, you know. I mean, the Greenville Air Base. When we took over the Greenville Air Base for all of the black plantation workers who had been evicted because they had tried to register to vote. So we were doing economic development, we were doing cultural pieces, we were doing a lot of stuff.
I just wanted to add that. In its early days, SNCC was devoted to direct action. That's what we called it, you know, sit-ins and so forth. But it became clear that one of the basis for this horrible discrimination that is, when I talk to young people, they really, it's difficult to grasp the extent of segregation and terror in the South, that the basis of that was tied to voting. Mm-hmm. And there were many counties in Mississippi, for example, that were majority black counties. The old Civil Rights Commission, used to issue a report every year, and it would say how many thousands of potential voters, and there would be one mm-hmm. African American voter in a black majority county. It was outrageous. So that caused some dissension in SNCC about whether to go that way. And people felt, well, you know, it's not really out there on the lines and on the, it turned out to be the most dangerous and the most serious challenge.
Registering voters.
Was registering voters. And that, if that could have succeeded, I mean, and it did succeed in many respects, that would alter the political landscape of the country.
Which it did.
Which it did, yeah. Exactly. We can get to that, yeah.
Well, I was one of the creations of SNCC Energy, although there were other organizations that were involved, was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which was an alternate political party. It was meant to demonstrate to the country the exclusion of African Americans from the voting process, and had precinct meetings, county meetings, a statewide election. There were delegates that were chosen for the 1964 Democratic Convention. And I know we were talking earlier, Mark, about the fact that you had gone to Atlantic City, but that was where the convention challenge, the challenge to the Mississippi racist delegation was all white delegation was made, all white, all male,
right.
And there's a lot of history there, which is explored in a number of the books that are written.
But the thing that was amazing, I think, was also that as 19, 20, 21 year olds, which is what we were at that time, and then it's one of the things that we talk about in this book, we hope that young people will see themselves in us. That we may look like this now, you know, but we were once young, you know. So, hello, we're fabulous.
Looking good.
Yes,
looking good.
That's right.
Looking good.
That's right.
Looking good.
Yes. But one of the things that you get is that even at that age, we are doing the sophisticated political organizing. Oh. And so it's not just about how do you get black people registered to vote without getting them killed. It is also how do you build an alternate political party in the same way that we were doing an alternate, we were doing freedom schools. Because how do you do something that's alternate to this racist structure? And when we did the MFDP, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, we did it according to the Democratic Party rules. We crossed every T. We dotted every I. Ms. Baker was honchoing the lobbying effort out of Washington, D.C. When we went to Atlantic City, we knew who on the credentials committee was going to vote to at least get this question onto the floor of the convention. Mm-hmm. That's all we cared about at that point. Just get it on the floor. Let people hear. And so we had all these credential members who said they were going to vote for us, you know. And we're doing this at the age of 18, 19, 20 years old. And so when we get there, a number of folks said they were going to vote just to get us out on the floor. And then, of course, you know, Hubert Humphrey and Lyndon Johnson say, oh, wait a minute, you know, we need the Dixiecrat vote. We need all these racist Southerners. And so, because we want to win the election. And so they start just pulling the rug out. I mean, they cut us off at the knees. Our former friends. I mean, I come from a labor family, okay? My father helped organize the United Auto Workers Local in Tarrytown, New York, at the plant, the Fisher Body plant. And so for me, you know, my mother thought Walter Reuther, the then head, was the greatest thing since for whatever. And he's one of those who says, no, you know, we've got to back, you know, the traditional party because we don't want to lose the election. And you MFDP people, you know, you need to go for this compromise of just two at-large votes, you know. So the people we thought were our staunch friends, we found there was a betrayal. And we found out that, in fact, politics was not about morality. It was about power. And so that's what fuels us when we go into Lowndes County and build what is really an all-black political party.
In 1965, the original Black Panthers.
That's right. Yes, exactly. Because it's an 80% African-American population, not one registered voter in Lowndes County, Alabama. Not one. Yeah.
And that was, even though this is not about women, what I'm about to say. But I think that people, that particular campaign showed the brilliance of Stokely Carmichael.
Going in a lounge, you mean?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And as an organizer, and people like to malign him for a lot of reasons, but...
Mm. Oh, no, but he could organize. He was also brilliant. When we were doing... totally brilliant, and funny as hell, which is the other thing people don't see. But when... I'm sorry, I digress. Never mind.
That's okay, we'll come back. So I do want to digress for a moment.
Okay.
And I want to come back, because all the things you touched on here, I want to kind of talk about in greater depth, especially in terms of what it meant to be young and in the South doing this work of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and how it relates to the world we're in today in 2010, in this 21st century. Because I think there are a lot of interesting things, especially some of these you were talking about, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. But I'd like to just go through the three of you and And yes, talk about your reasons for joining, where you came from, how you ended up as 18, 19, 20-year-old young women going to the South where your lives would be in danger to fight in the civil rights movement to break the back of segregation in America. So talk, let's just go right down the line. We'll start with you, Betty Robinson.
Right, so
it's your home. Let's start with you.
Yeah. I was a college student in upstate New York, Skidmore College. And I was involved with the National Student Association, which was the organization of student government leaders around the country. And at these congresses that were held every summer, there was a lot of discussion about things like apartheid in South Africa, the Algerian Revolution, and segregation in the South. So there was a network of student government people, leaders. And when February 1st, 1960 happened, we already had a little organization on campus, but we were blown away to learn that African American students could not be served at a lunch counter. So we quickly organized, and in fact, I have the leaflet still. It says the right to eat. Negro students in the South don't have the right to eat. And then we go into, this is hysterical, we go into at Bennington, at Yale, at Harvard, at Smith. They are organizing to support the students, so we need to do that too. So come to a mass meeting. And we held several mass meetings on the campus. 60 to 200 women come to those meetings, debate, discuss, what are we going to do? And we finally decide that we're going to march to the Woolworths. And this is an all-women's college at the time.
In Pennsylvania, right?
No, in upstate New York.
Upstate New York.
No, no, Judy's the one in Pennsylvania.
That's right.
Swarthmore. No, this is Skidmore. It's an all-women's school. It's on the conservative side, very Republican. We marched to the downtown. In fact, there's a picture in my kitchen of the picket because they put it up at the 50th reunion. We march downtown, and then we come back, and I'm a senior at that point. And two other women were the leaders with me. And then the underclassmen say to us, "We can't stop now. We can't stop now." And we're like, "Oh, yeah, we did what we're going to do. We did our march." And they're like, "No, we can't stop." So we end up having a plan to send four women down to picket the Woolworths every hour the next day. And they get picked up by the police. And then the struggle becomes our own right to express our feelings. But at the same time, so then I began fundraising for SNCC and supporting the, there was actually some of the stuff that's not talked about a lot in the history is this incredible network of students on campuses in the North, young Christian students, Northern Student Movement, SDS, SNCC, and one that I'm leaving out that I can't remember right now. Anyway, this is this incredible network of students from across the country that ends up being part of something called the Southern Student Freedom Fund. And we're working on every campus to send money, to send supplies, to have the Freedom Singers come and sing, to really support our fellow, our age group, the young people in the South who are taking the risks. So then fast forward, I go to graduate school at Berkeley, and, this is also the time where it talks about students need to play a role in the world, and you need to make a contribution, and we read about social movements through history, and I decide, along with many others, that the way that we'll really change the country and bring those principles, those democratic principles that we were raised on, to fruition is to go south and join the movement. And so in 64, that's what I do. I drop out of graduate school and go south.
And go to Atlanta.
And go to Atlanta, exactly.
Which
and
then is where I the go SNCC headquarters were then.
Right. I go to the Atlanta office, and then I go to Mississippi for the summer of 64, and then I come back to Atlanta. And I'm the key job that I, role that I play is to nurture all of these northern groups that are organizing, the Friends of SNCC groups that are organizing to provide not just funds, but political support. So calls to congressmen, demonstrations at federal offices, articles in the newspaper, calls to jails when people get arrested. So incredible numbers of people all across the country who participated in the northern support arc of the movement, in addition, of course, to the millions of people in the South who marched and demonstrated and sat in and went to bravely to register to vote.
Oh, Judy Richardson, okay. Yes.
That's right. I'm still with you. Well, I come in. I'm originally from Tarrytown, New York, which is about 45 miles north of the city. And I go down to Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, good Quaker college, and I'm on a full four-year scholarship. My mother has no money. My father had died on the assembly line when I was seven. And so I go in as a freshman, right, in 1962, and I find that there's an SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, chapter on campus called SPAC, Swarthmore Political Action Committee. And so I go to the meeting just on a lark, you know, and to find out what's going on. And I find that they are trying to work with the all-black cafeteria staff on campus to try and get them a better wage, because it was just so minimal at that point. And also to get, more rights for them. But also they're working in Chester, Pennsylvania nearby on tutorials, but they're also working with Gloria Richardson and the Cambridge, Maryland movement on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. So first of all, I was a work-study student, so I was actually working in the cafeteria as a waitress. And one of the things they were trying to get for the wait staff was that there was a big pipe in the cafeteria, which was really, really hot, but had never been wrapped, and so it was exposed. And oftentimes, the regular black staff would back into it and would get burned and stuff, and of course, the administration never did anything about it. Well, I, student, back into it and really got seared to the point that for years later, I had H2O backwards on my calf of my leg. Hmm. But of course, that's when the administration gets upset. So they bring me in, you know, they think that I'm going to sue them or something. And that's how we got, though, through that, then we got the thing wrapped, right? But then I start going down on the bus to Cambridge, Maryland. And at that point, Cambridge had the right to vote. Black folks could vote for years, I mean, from the 40s. But what they couldn't do was go into any of the public facilities. So I go on the bus really, again, as a lark. It's because my mother's not there to stop me. And so I get on the bus, you know, what can I say? And we go down, and I just come in through that movement. The staff person there from SNCC, because SNCC was helping Gloria Richardson work in the community, and Reggie Robinson, who was from Baltimore himself, he said, "Oh, I'm going down to the national office. Why don't you come down, and then we'll come back up to Cambridge." So I go down, and I meet Jim Foreman, and Foreman finds out that I'm from Swarthmore, and so he assumes that I can write a literate sentence. Not necessarily true, let me just say, but that's his assumption, and that I can type 90 words a minute, and that I take shorthand, which is, as I say, like texting, but with symbols instead of words. So
I never thought about the shorthand like that.
Yes, exactly, because right, nobody knows shorthand anymore. I still do it, by the way. But anyway, so I stay there, and that's when I come in, and then we move as Dottie, with Dottie and Betty, we move the whole national office of SNCC from Atlanta to Greenwood, Mississippi in the summer of 64. And then I come back and I go into, I do some other things after that.
That you stay with SNCC till 66?
I stay to 66 because we go into Lowndes. I go into Lowndes with Stokely, and I go into Cordele, Georgia, Southwest Georgia before that. And I should mention, by the way, Lowndes County was possible because there was a really strong local organization. Because what Stokely does is he, on the Selma March, he is contacted by the local leader of the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, and who says, "Well, you know, would you come work with us?" And what's great is there's this new scholarship coming out, by the way. So there's a great book called Bloody Lowndes, written by this young black guy scholar up at The Ohio State, because you can't just say Ohio State. It's The Ohio State. He mentions this laughingly to me. but his name is Hassan Jeffries, and it's a really wonderful book that talks about how it's like what happens in a lot of the local organizing. There are people there before you who plow the ground, who make the soil, you know, and who say, "Yes, please come and work with us." And that's what happens with Lowndes.
Dottie. Dottie Zellner.
Okay. Well, the good thing about being third in line is it gives me a chance to focus. Well, I would want your viewers and your listeners to know that the three of us sitting here worked together in the Greenwood, Mississippi office 46 years ago.
That's true.
Okay. You all worked together in Greenwood, Mississippi.
Yeah, that's right. We all moved together down. Yeah.
And we all basically did the same job, which was to man to woman the hotline, which I won't go into. And that, you know, consisted, you know, "Hello, Mrs. So-and-so, I'm sorry to say that your son, your daughter is in jail, and, you know, we need bond money, and who's your congressman," and so forth. Mm-hmm.
But also to keep in, because we always had every day all of the local. All the local projects had to call into this. It was basically an 800 number.
Right.
And if we did not hear from them, then we would try and track them down and make sure they were okay.
Right. And the local people would too.
Yes.
In my case, I was 7 years old when World War II ended. So I remember the war. And I remember, as being a Jewish person in a Jewish family, this incredible, horrible anxiety about what was happening. And when I actually remember when the concentration camps were opened and the effect that it had on my family. And I couldn't understand it. And I said to my father something like, where was everybody? Mm. I mean, I said, and in the case of the Jews, I said, how did they know who we were? And actually, they didn't know who we were, and they made us register. And then they knew who we were, so they could come and kill us. Okay. So I think the question in my family, a left-wing family, was, you cannot stand idly by. I mean, that comes from the Bible, but it was translated into everyday life. And so, you know, I was politically active as a teenager and in high school and college and so forth. And I identified so much with these heroic tales. You know, it's kind of romantic, you know, the Warsaw Ghetto. I would imagine, you know, I'm a native Manhattanite. So I would imagine, well, would I be brave enough to be on the roof shooting at the Nazis if they were marching up Second Avenue?
Up Second Avenue!
I love it. That's good. I like that.
So... then, guess what? I mean, the moment happened, and, you know, everybody wants to recreate that moment. Unfortunately, it's a confluence of so many different factors. That moment was the sit-in moment, and I remember exactly where I was sitting when I read about it in the paper, and then I said, well, I have to go down. I was in this little coffee shop near the 42nd Street Library. Smoking.
It tasted good back then. It did.
We
all smoked.
Drinking coffee, we were in New York Times smoking. And someday I have to find out what page they actually put it on, but I think it was page 16 or something like that. It was in the back pages. And then through a...
What was on the page?
The sit-in.
Greensboro.
The story, four guys had been arrested.
Greensboro, North Carolina.
Sitting at this counter. And I actually was at the moment sitting at a counter when I was reading this. And I thought, oh, how clever, how creative. I mean, I didn't know that there had been sit-ins before. I didn't know that. And I thought, oh, you know, they just sat there and they just said, you know, we're sitting here. We're not going to budge. What young people don't realize, which I have to remember to say all the time, is that the sit-in movement was a movement to break laws. I mean, the legal structure made it legal to segregate. So everybody was breaking a law. And most people, that has flown out of most people's consciousness. That's why it was so serious for young black students, as you'll see in the book, to break a law, because that meant you could be expelled from school, you know, not to mention your family disgrace, you know, quote unquote disgrace.
And going to jail.
And going to jail, and bond money, and where would it come from, and so forth.
But also because it was as part of the heritage that all these people, black Southerners grew up with, was you go into Parchment, you don't come back out again. Yeah.
So in my case, through a series of various things, that's when I decided I had to go. And first I went with CORE. And then finally through various...
The Congress of Racial Equality.
Congress of Racial Equality, but it was SNCC. Everybody said, it's SNCC, you have to get to SNCC.
Got to be in SNCC.
Fortunately for me, I got there. But, I mean, there's a whole other story about... I thought, here I was a college graduate. Fortunately for me, I knew how to type. You see, now the women's movement has said... Oh, all the women, they did all the typing. Well, I was so lucky. I mean, when I walked into the office and I met Foreman, you know, he said, hello, how can you type?
James Foreman,
I mean,
we're talking about. Jim Foreman.
Oh, the great James
The leader
Foreman.
Of SNCC.
Yeah. And he said...
One of the leaders. Thank you for saying that. Okay. One of the leaders.
And he said, oh, hello, and what's your name? And blah, blah, can you type? I mean, it was like, there was no segue. It was, can you type? And I said, yes. I was a volunteer then. Well, let's say I didn't know how to type. What was I going to do? I mean, or were they going to send a New Yorker, see the way I speak? I lived in the South for 20 years. I still speak this way. If I even say hello to somebody, I would say hello. They'd say, where are you from in New York? So were they going to send this young Jewish woman who spoke like this out into the wilds of Lowndes County? No. So thank goodness I knew how to type. And then, of course, Foreman being Foreman and Snick being Snick, I said to him, you know, I can also write. And lo and behold, I ended up working with Julian Bond on the press. And that's what I did basically all those years. And we did the student voice and we did some
the student stuff. Voice,
so,
right.
So that to me is sort of a paradigm. You know, you use the skills that you have, but then we were in an organization where you could use all your skills, not just some of your skills. Well, he knew, he would ask you what you could do. And just like this, he knew where you belonged, what you could do. Mm-hmm. It was phenomenal.
Well, and that's the short story. Were you done?
No, I'm done.
So just to add to that, I mean, that's how I got recruited by Jim, because he saw what I was doing in the North. And then he said, you've got to come south. And of course, I debated whether I could do that or not. Would I be brave enough? Could I take that risk? Mm-hmm. And I ended up leaving graduate school and traveling across the country on a train to Atlanta. Jim was a brilliant organizer, incredible, masterful.
Amazing human being.
Amazing human
as many
being.
As many of you were.
Yes, this is true.
Yeah.
As many of you were. We're in Betty Robinson's home. And
I have to say, we're amazing. But people don't realize that they're amazing,
and
too.
And they can do it. Mm-hmm.
See, I mean, is there anything, if we walk down the street, would anybody think that we were anything other, and we were just look like normal people? We are normal people. but normal people can do amazing things. They have no idea they can do them.
We have to take a very brief break here, and then I'm going to come back and kind of pick up on that idea and some other ideas we've been talking about. We're in Betty Robinson's home. We're talking about Hands on the Freedom Plow with Betty Robinson, Dottie Zellner, and Judy Robinson. Judy Richardson, excuse me. Judy Richardson. And talking about the women of SNCC, Hands on the Freedom Plow. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. I'm Mark Steiner. We're still here in Betty Robinson's dining room talking about Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC, with two of the other editors of this book, Judy Richardson and Dottie Zellner. You all painted such a picture of your lives at that moment. And there's so much to kind of pull from in all the things you talked about. But let me just pick on a few parts here. One of the things you all just finished talking about was breaking the law. Mm-hmm. And the law said segregation was legal, just like the law said slavery was legal. Mm-hmm. And the Fugitive Slave Act says you could legally catch a free person and bring them back into slavery. Mm-hmm. So people broke the law. Now, we're in a world in 2010 mm-hmm. where the notion of breaking the law is an anathema. It was, people weren't too popular when we broke the law back in the 60s yes. either, but I mean, but let's talk about that idea and what people did consciously, what you all did consciously in the civil rights movement, breaking the law and what that meant and what it means for now.
And what it meant for all of the local people in the communities to actually step out and risk, because, I mean, the three of us came from the North and we brought a certain amount of privilege, you might say, with us. We had our education, but you had people, sharecroppers in local communities that lost their jobs, whole families that were set out on the street because they dared to register to vote, because they dared to be a part of the movement. And so the people who, I think, took the greatest risk, or churches that were bombed, mm-hmm. so ministers who opened their churches to hold mass meetings, who those churches were then bombed in the middle of the night. So the people who were the heroes and heroines were really the local people in those communities right. that SNCC went into and organized.
All right, so Mark, you asked about breaking the law. The fact is that the people who run this country and the people who have power have been breaking the law forever, forever. They've broken human rights law forever. The concept now is that if you're on the outside and you're marginalized, you have to obey the law. But the question is never raised about the people in power, whether they have broken the law. And that's the kind of dialogue and discourse that we have to have now. Because, you know, Woody Guthrie said it best, you know, you don't have to have a gun, you need a fountain pen to steal, right? And that's what's been happening. That's what's happened. And the people are going to have to consider, again, in my opinion, whether they will take the risk that people took 45 years ago and 50 years ago. Because we are, I think, going definitely down the tube. We are going down the tube. And the very same questions that we had 50 years ago are the questions now. Do you stand by and do nothing? Do you do something? If somebody, an Arab American, is being persecuted because they are a Muslim or they are an Arab, do you stand by? Do you say nothing? Do you let them take your house, steal your house? The banks are stealing. Talk about law. The banks are stealing. So those are all the questions. Those are the questions that we have to revive.
Yeah, another aspect of that question is the struggle now in the country as to who is a real American. Mm-hmm. So Arab Americans are not thought to be real Americans. They're not loyal. Latinos or other immigrants are thought to be illegal aliens, not part of the country. And so just as there was a battle, and then, of course, in the Black community, the incredible statistics of 50% of young men of color incarcerated or in conjunction with the legal system. So the powers that be have, on some level, pacified the communities of color in the cities around, with this jail chain. And I think we're called upon, and, you know, I have a nice little quote from Fanon here, which I'm going to read.
Frantz Fanon,
who was a Black doctor from Martinique, who was involved in France and with the Algerian Revolution and so on. But he says, each generation must, out of relative obscurity, realize its mission, fulfill it or betray it. And for my generation, which he was speaking in the 50s, I truly believe tomorrow is ours. But I think that this is significant for this generation, and it should be multi-generational too. I mean, there are many of us who are still willing to really fight to transform the country and to, you know, bring it back to its ideals and its course.
I mean, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the pantheon of civil rights organizations was considered a radical group, even within the civil rights pantheon.
Yes.
I mean, and was told to slow down.
Yes.
Don't go out there and do what you do to miss the Freedom Summit. That's my thing. There's a lot of groups within that. But the sit-ins, the Freedom Rides, stop. Mm-hmm. Don't do it.
Yes.
You're pushing it too hard. Even the SCL, Martin Luther King's group, there was a real split there.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're talking about, breaking the law, you're talking about pushing the envelope, talking about pushing to organize and do things in a different way, that was really even going against the grain of some of the people in the civil rights movement and some of the fear raised among Black folks in the South, regular citizens of those communities.
No, as a matter of fact, I remember Stokely coming back, who becomes Kwame Ture, but Stokely coming back from a Big Five, Big Six meeting of the several major civil rights organizations. And I picked him up at the airport, and he talks about how Gloucester Current, who is the director of branches, at some point, Stokely said, you know, well, the grassroots, and he was talking about the grassroots folks who were organizing in Mississippi, and he mentions the grassroots, and Gloucester Current, director of branches of the NAA, says, I'm tired of hearing about all these grassroots. Forget about these grassroots people. Because, see, what's interesting is that when we went into Mississippi particularly, there were local NAA branches, NAACP branches, that welcomed us. Mm-hmm. You know, just could not wait, because even the national NAA at that point was very moderate. And it was fine to get the money from these local, you know, rural areas of Mississippi, Alabama, Southwest Georgia, But the main thing was, as the spokespeople, you know, you were supposed to, you know, speak the Queen's English, you know, you're right. supposed to do a certain thing. You're supposed to be, you know, so what they were looking for was the middle class, at that point, Negro. Okay. And so they, in some ways, did not really want to lift up the kind of folks that we were organizing, the strength that had been organizing in these communities for decades before we ever got there. And so when we come into them, it's like, oh, this is new blood. You know, these are young people who really want to work with us, who actually want to listen to what we want to do in our areas. And so it wasn't so much even, it was intergenerational. It wasn't so much about organizations when you're on the ground. It really is about who wants to work on these common issues. And forget, I mean, for example, we welcomed people from the Communist Party, as long as you did not organize for the CP while you were in our organization, right? So the main thing was, you come in, as long as you go with our agenda, we didn't care who you were. So the NAA is saying during the summer of 64, we will no longer support the Mississippi action, the Mississippi Freedom Summer. So, I mean, we're working with LCDC, the Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee, and they had been, you know, the right wing and the moderates were saying, oh, those, you know, they're Reds, they're communist tin, they're communist sympathizers, whatever. We didn't care. If you will work with our agenda, we will work with you. And so the NAACP says, well, we will not work with you, because they had to worry about their funders. And their funders were saying, you don't work with anything that, you know, basically the federal government and others, you know, will have problems with. And as a matter of fact, there were a number of organizations that were like that. And then we just said, you know, whoever will let them come, as long as you work with what we want to do.
In fact, after the summer of 64, into the winter of 65, some of these established civil rights organizations were meeting in private, fearing that there was going to be another Mississippi summer, the second summer in 65, and that if there was going to be another one, to make sure that SNCC was not in the leadership of that. So that, I hope that, do you understand?
Absolutely.
So they were, that was on the table. As it turns out, there were no plans for another summer, Freedom Summer. But that was the issue. We were definitely radical. We were out there. We were definitely out there, not only in the tactics, but the fact that, like Judy says, that, you know, we welcomed everybody. This was at the tail end of the McCarthy days. You know, we didn't believe in investigating people. In fact, we took a position in 63 that if SNCC was ever subpoenaed, if members of SNCC were ever subpoenaed before one of these ridiculous investigative committees, that they were going to refuse to cooperate. And that was in 63. So they definitely knew that we were out there.
And I just wanted to add one other little piece. I think that, again, going back to the local communities, our power was that we gave voice to the local communities and were able to organize. And it's not that we were responsible for doing the organizing. We were able to be the catalyst, the facilitator for those local communities to find their voice and their place in this larger movement. So I think that is a key thing as organizers.
Could I also hook on to that in terms of when we were talking about breaking the law? Because, I mean, I sometimes see anarchists also at some of these demonstrations. They're breaking the law too. That's not what we were talking about. We were always community-based. There was a community that said, this is the kind of stuff we want to do. I mean, even when the four young people go down to that sit-in that got so much recognition in 1960, they are NAACP youth chapter people. They have been talking to their elders as well. They know they will get support from the community when they do it. And it's not that you always have to know that, but you can't just say, okay, I'm going to do this by myself, and let's just see who else joins us. I think you really do have to think about how you organize, how you are representative of a community feeling on this. Yeah.
So it's really important, because what you were saying also is the distinctions between breaking windows and smashing cars and breaking unjust laws.
Yes.
Whether that would mean today stopping someone from his house, from being evicted from their home.
Right.
Which is a really important difference to make there. I have to come back to almost the beginning and ask you all why it was important to write a book about the women of SNCC. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about that. I'm sure maybe people are too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Charlie Cobb, who is one of the eminent SNCC field secretaries, he has recently done a blog like 3 weeks ago, and he talks...
Well, he wrote on The Root, which is a blog. It's not his blog, but it's
Sorry.
It's Salon's black blog.
Yeah. That's right.
And I don't have the exact wording, but he refers to the invisibility of women. And I was thinking about this. You know, we were in an unbelievably sexist country at the time. And that sexism, of course, has continued in subtle ways. Some of the women in this book have never had their names printed anywhere. So people have to say, why is that the case? This mass meeting, the photo that's on this, the cover of the book, which is mostly women, anybody who went to mass meetings in the communities, I would say 70% of the people were women at the mass meetings.
These are local community women.
Local community women.
Right. Black women in the South.
Yes.
That's right. Because this is Albany, Georgia. This is Southwest Georgia.
Yeah. This picture's from Georgia.
The picture on the cover is from Southwest Georgia. It's an AP photo. But what it is, and you will see the caption on it, is that this is at a mass meeting at a black church, and the papers that the women are holding are promises to go to jail the next day. And all of them are holding these little pieces of paper. Yeah. And this is Southwest Georgia. And I'm not talking, you know, Atlanta, the city too busy to hate. This was Southwest Georgia. Yeah.
So in addition to the women being invisible, I think that a lot of the historiography has focused on certain people. You know, for young people, learning about the civil rights movement in elementary school or in high school, they basically, it's boiled down to, you know, Dr. King had a dream and Mrs. Parks sat down.
Right.
And it's certain individuals, and what's lost is the tremendous number, the hundreds of thousands of people who were involved in this movement. Half, I would say, at least half of which were of whom were women, and that's one of the reasons for this book.
And
not that the men have you know made sure that we were never mentioned. It's I think just part of the culture. The culture.
It's part of our culture. And what you just said, Julia Richardson about this picture on the cover in Southwest Georgia, that in any given time, 70% of the people in mass community meetings in the black communities in the South who were fighting for human rights were women. And the power of women to be in that struggle. And I'm looking at Ella Baker behind us. Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yes.
Who came, was a sharecropper.
That's right.
You know, and led the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. I mean, it's those are some really powerful, important stories, I think, in a time of huge sexism, as you were talking about. Blatant sexism, as opposed to the hidden sexism in the world today.
Right, exactly.
Blatant sexism.
Blatant. That's right.
The other dimension of this is that historians and others write history from the great man theory, as opposed to the great social movement theory, or the fact that the change is very often made from this with this groundswell from below. And I think we're at a period of time again where in each part of this country, there can be and needs to be a groundswell from below, and that's another reason for talking about the book. We were not special people. We were not magnetic leaders. We were people who were dedicated to the values and the principles of the civil rights movement and of that transformative change that we wanted to bring about.
So clearly, you put this book together, Hands on the Freedom Plow. You six women. Three black, three white, from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, to do something more than just have remembrances, to have like something like akin to a yearbook. This is something for you all that is a lesson and about where we are today in many ways, talking to the generation that you were then now, the young people today.
And we are passing on the way history is taught in this country is memorizing tedious, you know, dates and battles and so forth. But history makes you who you are, and it doesn't have to be your own history. It can be somebody else's history. If I read about Harriet Tubman, what does that mean to me, the great, you know, facilitator of of escaped slaves. First of all, it means to me that a woman who could not read or write can do these things. That means I can do something. Mm. So what we are doing is we're giving a gift of our history so that other people, it becomes theirs, and they can act on it. Act on it.
And I think, I mean, because that's so important, because we came through a time, particularly before young people really got involved in Obama, for whatever that meant, where they really thought, oh, something's wrong with us, that we are not. I mean, I would talk on a campus, and it would be when Bush was dropping the bombs, right, and on Iraq. And they would say, look, I have the same three people in my meetings against the war. And I say, like, first of all, if all the people who said they were in the movement were in the movement, we'd be free now. Hello. The other problems. We make it seem, even in Eyes on the Prize, the series, that, you know, you have three people at a meeting, and then suddenly 20,000 people are marching across the Pettus Bridge in Selma, you know, in 1965. It never happens that quickly. So it really is a small process. And sometimes you would have a mass meeting where there would be three people. It would be you, the local organizer, and her mother. You know, I mean, it's that's it. So it takes time, and you never know when the spark is going to jump off. But if you do nothing, then nothing changes.
And if you know nothing, nothing happens.
Yes, that's the other thing.
And that's what this book is.
But it's also about transforming. I mean, we were not the way we are now when we come into SNCC. You know, we get changed. We get transformed by the people and the energy around us. And so we become different people.
Right.
And we become more able and more assured and more, you know, and more, a better sense of the purpose that we were put here to, you know, to fulfill, kind of. And so you change. You get changed by the movement itself.
And I think we're also finding that the book is becoming an organizing tool. Mm-hmm. Because everywhere we've been, everywhere we've made presentations, and there are many more planned, all the contributors in the book are working to do events on their local campuses and their regions. But everywhere we go, first of all, the books sell out before the programs begin.
Talk about yesterday.
Good thing.
Yesterday.
Seriously, Red Emma's last night had a program. It was a book celebration of the book, and they got 40 books. The books were sold before 15 minutes before the program even began. And there were over 100 people there, and people emailing me today saying, Betty, where can I get a copy of this book? I want you to autograph it. Mm-hmm. Where should I go? I need to give it as a gift for my mother, for my daughter, et cetera, et cetera.
And that happened in Cambridge, too.
That
Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Cambridge.
We had it the main, yes, but we had it at the main public. I mean, we've been having it all over the country. Mm-hmm. Main Public Library in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we sold out. Harvard Bookstore was doing it. We had two books sold out before the panel began. Okay.
The same thing
at the Brooklyn Museum. Yeah,
Brooklyn Museum. Same thing.
Same thing. Exactly. But it's becoming an organizing tool and a way to speak to young people who are despairing about the state that the country's in, who are not clear what their future holds because of their college loans, number one, number two, because there are no jobs. So it's going to be a great ride that we're on.
Well, I'll tell you what we will do. It will be on our website, steinershow.org, how to buy this book.
Yes.
Great. Okay.
With chapters from this book you can look at as well.
We also have a Facebook page.
Which is?
Facebook page.
Which is Hands on the Freedom Plow.
Hands on the Freedom Plow, exactly.
So
and you can go on at University of Illinois Press also and see the calendar of events where we will be having book parties.
And we'll have all that on our website as well. Right. And so I want to thank you, first of all, Betty Robinson, for opening your home. And Judah Richardson, Dottie, it's always great to have you here and meet both of you. It's been great. Hands on the Freedom Plow. When you get to our website, steinershow.org, you will see how to get this book, more about this book. And so here we are from Baltimore, Maryland, and Betty Robinson's home, Hands on the Freedom Plow, personal accounts of women by women in SNCC, here for WEA Public Radio and Free Speech TV. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.